He had not realized by then, you know, what was in store. But Dhyasaranayaka took the next logical step, which probably Sundaralingam had not either anticipated or was not conscious about. Whatever it is.
No, yeah. When I asked the question, I was referring to 39 when Nehru came.
Yes.
I was wondering whether Sundaralingam had some influence on those talks and...
I don't think so.
If I may, that's just a digression. If I may jump to Kotha Lawal, what was his policy, particularly in 54? And
you see, I think Kotha Lawal was really more interested in political, shall I say, now the man is not in power, it is not nice to use, you know, such words about him, but political stunt, you know, as one might call it.
Sort of kind of kudos.
Yes, you see, oh, I have done this and I have done that and I have done that. All along wanting to sort of pamper, you know, to the racial sentiments of people.
Without going too far.
Without going too far and without even assessing as to what would be the ultimate, you know, result of a particular step, you know, that he had taken.
In other words, much more short-sighted than D.S.
Much more short-sighted than D.S.
So he didn't have these considerations of the lifeblood and, you know...
He was conscious of the first aspect of the matter, because he was essentially a sort of an anti-socialist type of person. He was. And he was conscious of the first matter, you know, that the workers might ultimately become, you know. But to my mind, he felt that, well, amongst the plantation workers, a sort of a wedge can be drawn. I mean, therefore, to that extent, he was not as anti-Indian, you know, as Dhyasaranayaka was, for example. But this fact was in his mind, all right.
And anyway, I presume that Oliver would have served to provide a continuity of policy, and he, Oliver at least, would have been aware of...
Yes. But I must say that Sir Oliver is one of the careless politicians in Assiram.
What about Bandar Nayaka? What was his attitude, especially after 56? In fact, were there any talks in his time?
56, no. No. But he did go with Sir John in 54. He did go with Sir John in 54. To Delhi, but there were no talks after he became Prime Minister. And my view is that he had, whatever he may have said earlier, by the time, you know, he became Prime Minister, I think a great deal of maturity in his thinking had come about on this issue. He ceased to be rabid. On the contrary, he took some concrete steps. Say, for example, in the matter of the Provident Fund. I don't know whether I told you that last time. The Provident Fund, I mean, he was the first Prime Minister who said that the Provident Fund scheme should be made applicable to all workers in the country, irrespective of race and nationality.
Any other steps that come to mind?
Well, that to my mind was a very, very big step. Not only that, but whenever the Indo-Ceylon issue came up in the parliament, you know, he always used to make it a point to say that this question must be handled in a human way, that you can't throw people, you know, into the sea. And if a problem has arisen, well, let us tackle it and not rush with it. That to my mind was a very great improvement on the earlier position that all the Prime Ministers had taken.
Isn't it surprising didn't the SRFP at that time have a much stronger anti-Indian attitude than the UNP, in the sense that the certain pressure groups there.
You mean in 1956?
After 56.
After 56. My impression is that even if such groups did exist, Bandar Nayaka personally was an obstruction to the development of that thinking, you know, in that group. You see, because I think by that time Bandar Nayaka had also begun to sort of see the reality of the situation, you know, the plantation economy and the need of the country, you know, to grow more tea and, you know, sort of not permitting to disrupt these things. And then, you know, Bandar Nayaka was essentially a democratic type of person. You know, he did not want to do things which would be, you know, which would go against the fundamental right of a person, you know, and even in his handling. Now, I will give you, even in his handling, you know, he sort of liked to utilize the popular, you know, movements to tackle a situation rather than, you know, use any big stick. Now, take for example, when these riots took place, you know, in 1958, in Boguntalawa, you know, some two persons, you know, were killed, two plantation workers, you know, were killed.
By?
During this communal, you know.
By single?
Yes. And he got the information, and you see, instead of leaving the matter in the hands of the army and the police and all that, you know, he contacted Thundaman and me on the telephone and said, well, you know, I don't want these army chaps to go and mess up the situation. That, you know, they will use more bullets. Would you not help me out, you see, in this matter and go and tackle the situation? You know, now, maybe that he thought that the army people, you know, will make the situation worse. Maybe that he was thinking of tea production. Maybe that he was thinking of, you know, various other matters of that nature. But the fact, you know, that he tried to go through the representatives of the people.
Was this after emergency or before?
I think it was after the emergency. Emergency was declared almost immediately, wasn't it? When the riots started in...
I don't know whether you heard this, but isn't it true that he was hesitating all along to declare emergency and even delayed it for too long till Gundevia saw him?
I don't know even if it is true. Actually, I have not verified this position in Gundevia. But even if it is true, it may not have been for the purpose of allowing the Singhalese to have their, you know...
No, I don't... Well, I think I would say that that was probably not true. But it was just that he was reluctant. He didn't reluctant to go that far and hadn't quite realized the gravity of the situation.
May not have realized the gravity of the situation. That is quite possible. He might have thought, well, these are, you know, things that can be brought under control, you know, with the handling by the police.
What was your position, or shall I say the CDWC, is it?
DWC.
DWC's position during the 56 elections, because for the first time there was no contest pact.
Yes. We supported the SLFP all over.
Weren't there some inner doubts about this in view of the fact that the SLFP included a very strong chauvinist group?
Well, yes, I mean, that hesitation with regard to the SLFP has always been there, has always been there. But, you see, the events of period prior to the 56 election, you know, showed that UNP was no different. So John Chakravala did not dare himself to bring in the single only proposal, asked Ananda Prasad Elvis, you know, to move it in the UNP conference, while he quietly went away to Australia. You know, these are all things, you see, which however cleverly you handle, you can't hide, you see, which really did show to many people that this was not, that UNP was really not very much different, you know, from...
Regarding chauvinist attitudes, both within and within the SLFP and UNP, you find them claiming that eventually the Tamils will drive us into the sea. They also ask that, at least some of them, I believe, ask that all the Indians be sent back. Do they do that?
I personally think that even those who say it, they don't believe that it is either feasible or necessary.
Yes, in fact, by implication, once they ask that, it means that the Sudanese workers are going to work the plantations.
which they themselves don't believe, at least not for the present.
Yes, sir.
At least not for the
present. So I can't see the how they can mount such things.
You see, now, take for example, the attitude that the LSSP has taken, leave aside the SLFP, LSSP,
yes,
which has all along, you know, supported the cause of the plantation workers, all along supported the cause of parity and all that. You see, you can't imagine that overnight, you know, they have completely forgotten all that they've talked or learnt or said. You see, today they are taking up this funny position of following the SLFP line as far as the language question goes, as far as the citizenship question goes. Now, you know, this is all because of a belief that the average voter, you know, is influenced by this type of thinking.
Now, if average single voter.
Yes, that is what they believe. Now, if educated and politically, you know, knowledgeable people like the LSSP leadership, you know, begin to think so, I mean, how can you claim the SLFP is, you know, supporter who hasn't had much, you know, political training or much political sort of education to analyze things? You see, to my mind, it is a mistaken belief that the Sinhalese man really gets influenced, you know, by this kind of thinking. I personally don't think that the average Sinhalese voter really is carried away, you know, by this type of thing.
On what grounds do you think so?
Now, you take the elections of 1960, where the UNP went hammer and tongs, you know, with regard to the SLFP-FP pact and, you know, the division of the country and all kinds of, you know, propaganda of that nature. While the SLFP went on the basis of accepting the minorities as they are, you know, in the country and to sort of give them their due rights, and that if the Tamils are here, well, they are here and we have got to accept them and things of that sort. And yet you find that the Sinhalese population, by majority, voted for the SLFP and defeated the UNP. The things got reversed in 1965. Where the UNP, you know, gave up this kind of propaganda. And SLFP, you know, went in the direction in which the UNP had gone in 1960. And the election results, you know, again showed that the UNP was returned and not the SLFP. Now, this goes to show that an average Sinhalese voter is really not sort of taken up by this kind of, maybe that a certain section of the people are taken up. But if you examine the results of 1960 and 1965, it goes to prove that an average Sinhalese voter is not that madly, you know, taken up by this kind of racial propaganda.
Why was there no contest pact in March 1960? I believe the CP tried to bring one about.
Yes, but as you know, in March 1960, you had, you know, the NMP thinking, 19th March premier.
NMP,
you know, that kind of thinking had got into their head, you see, and therefore you had no contest pact.
Did the CP approach you also?
And, well, you see, at that time the whole political scene had become completely confused, you know, and we
had also at that time, you know, sort of merged, you know, with the CWC, and there was a lot of confusion in our organization.
Oh, you also had merged temporarily?
Yes, we had. Not temporarily, we had merged with the intention of making it permanent, but it didn't last long. It lasted only 2 years, you know.
How did that merger come about? For what reason?
Well, the new situation, and then, you know, Tandaman said, well, let us forget about all these things, and we are unable to do anything, you know, with this kind of division and all that and all that.
What was that? When was that? In 59 or 59?
The talks had begun in 59. The actual merger took place, I think, in January 60.
The talks began after the assassination?
Talks began somewhere in the middle of 59, I think. When did the assassination take place?
September.
59?
So then in 60, I suppose by virtue of the fact that you were with Tondaman too, your position to the left would have had to be modified.
It had to be. Mm-hmm.
And anyway, what would have been your position in some of the plantation electorates with the about 5 or 6 candidates, MEP, LSSP, UNP, SLSP? Where?
Yes, we were in a sort of, as I told you, we were in a kind of a terrible, you know, mess ourselves. And there was no effective approach.
Did you give any instructions to the voters, or did you let them vote as they wished?
I think some kind of instruction was given, I now don't remember what. And the fact that I don't remember what, you know, itself shows that the instruction must have been all of that sort of, you know.
Vague type. Well, if I sort of read in final sphere, what comments have you to make on the Bandanayak, the Sirima or Shastri Pact? And in fact, what led to this, what enabled it to come about?
You see, as far as the pact is concerned, we are not very happy about the pact, you know, and the provisions in it. We are not happy about it, not only because it affects the persons of Indian origin who form the bulk of our membership, but we feel that it is harmful to the interests of the country itself, in the sense that while such a lot of work in the country, particularly in the field of agriculture, has got to be done, such trained labor, you know, will be exported out of the country just because of certain, you know, racial sentiments. Now, actually in my presidential address, I said, I can post you a copy, I said that we are having a strange phenomena that through the export of profits, you know, that we have now permitted, we are exporting potential capital out of the country and also exporting a trained labor out of the country, you know, at a time when we need more production and more, you know, investment. So that we feel that all our agricultural schemes and other things, you know, would have really advanced further if this labor was utilized, you know, for that purpose. Now, as far as the question of as far as this problem of racial, you know, composition of the population goes, after all, amongst the Sinhalese also, there is a very sharp division between the right and the left. And what is there to assume that there will be no such sharp division amongst the plantation workers as well? There is, in fact, sharp division.
Tandaman group and your
own? Yes, there is sharp division. Now, and therefore, our view is that that if it was believed that the plantation workers will sort of en bloc, you know, pull on one side or pull on the other side, or join, you know, with the northern and the eastern province, the best approach would be to try to integrate them, you know, into the national stream, rather than sort of try to throw them out of the country.
There are several comments arising. On the other hand, can't you say that, A, the fact that the numbers who remain are small would assist in integration, in that it's smaller, and B, isn't there much to be said for it in that settles the political problem, at least lessens the political problem, shall I say. There are still other questions like electoral, separate electoral registers and things, but it seems to settle the Indo-Ceylon question as India and Ceylon are concerned. And then obviously, I would say, from the humanitarian point of view, doesn't it help the estate labor in that they now know their position, they become nationals of one country or the other. It is true some have to be, some are rooted out from Ceylon and have to settle in a, what is virtually a new country. But at least the Indian government seems to be making efforts to help them find roads there. But what have you to say about those 3 points?
The fact that that settlement of this problem was necessary is not disputed. This is a question that had to be settled. But to be settled on this basis of numbers, settled on this basis of numbers, is what I say is incorrect, because it deprives the country of a very valuable asset. Now, the question of the small number being integrated and a larger number being integrated, you see, after all, if the integration, you know, starts taking place, to my mind, 1 or 200,000 more here or there really does not matter. Integration can take place only by a process of integration. The process of integration can be applied to 300,000 people, it can be applied to 500,000 people. Now, and this question has still not been settled, in the sense that if the 500,000 number is not reached,
If the 500,000 remaining in Ceylon.
Yes. You see, if the 500,000, which is a figure fixed for repatriation, is not reached, that means to say the 525,000 people don't apply for Indian nationality, what happens?
Oh, does it depend on national application?
Of course. It has to be, otherwise how else can you solve the problem? If suppose I am a stateless person and I say that I don't want to go back to India, what can you do to me? How can the government of India catch hold of me and say, look, you fellow, you will have to get out from me? How can you? You see, now, what will happen? You see, what will happen is that if 525,000 people are not reached,
or I say 400,000, let's say 125,000 not reached.
No, to that extent, a proportionate number would not be given Ceylon citizenship also. So that you have not only 125,000 people, but you have a 4/7 of 125 on the other side also, remaining here in the state. And you would have created a kind of a funny situation that the poor chap who wants to become a Ceylon national, he won't be able to become a Ceylon national. You know, the whole approach, you know, is a sort of a illogical approach. You see, that one poor chap who wants to become a Ceylon national, who for all purposes, you see, is thinking in a way the Ceylon is, he identifies himself, you know, politically, you know, with Ceylon. In every respect, he wants to become a Ceylon. He can't become a blessed Ceylon because the 125,000 people have not taken Indian nationality. And if they become the 125,000 people also don't become Ceylon national, then what happens? You know, the problem with respect to this, you know, remains. Now, the only advantage that would emerge out of this would be, but this advantage can be a disadvantage also, as I will explain it to you. The only advantage that can emerge out of this is that proceeding on some basis that has been laid down, proceeding on the basis that has now been laid down, some people will become Indian nationals and some people will become Ceylon nationals. That's all. The rest of the problem of not only the 150,000 people, but also the 525,000 people will still be Indian.
What then is your solution, say we don't have this? What would you have preferred?
You see, all along we have been saying that let the government of Ceylon announce its scheme of inducement. Right? So if you want to go, we will give you so much. Because that was what was contemplated in the 1954 Nehru Prastav affair. Right? On the other hand, government of India also to have its own rehabilitation scheme, because that itself will be an inducement, you know, to the people here who would desire to go back to India.
At this point, the recording of the interview had to be stopped because it was too hard to understand. It was going too fast. End of interview with A. Aziz, on the 23rd of September, 1967.
Protest. Anyway, it's conception.
Its original intention was to force the government into withdrawing the inclusive price of rice. And there's no more than a protest. There was an intention of trying to do it. But the first thing was to register a protest. Second was trying to get them to withdraw the cost of the rise in the price of rice. There was no intention there to take part. Though such a situation did exist in Colombo on the end of of 13, because the police and the other forces were so demoralized that by the end of the 13th, such a situation was there in Colombo. But it would have been foolish because it would have taken part in Colombo and not waited for more than a couple of days. So, but no one thought about it, it was not even considered. Because we called it off on that day.
Whose idea was it? I mean, in the sense, who thought of the
trade? We did. The first, through the trade union, we our trade unions were the first to initiate this whole business. There's a little book that I published at the time called One Day That Shook Ceylon, which gives you, gives you all the documents and so on.
I wonder what sort of steps you were able to take to gain mass participation in the protest.
Mostly meetings. We had, you know, it was not really like the election campaign. We had lots of meetings, rallies, lectures, leaflets. And mind you, on the other side, the papers were against us, the government was thundering against us, threatening us.
Were you able to use Radio Ceylon?
No, we didn't. We had the newspaper even that time. Well, we spoke, you know, like it was like election, in the sense we spoke about 5-6 meetings a day, different parts of the country.
Trade union grapevine?
Well, that's only in Colombo and plantations.
To what extent did the CIC or CWC join?
They didn't join. They under pressure, they backed out. But they sort of held meetings and so forth, but they didn't join the strike.
Wasn't that a weak spot in the sense that...
It was a weak spot because, they originally were going to come in. But there was terrific pressure on them from the government. And I think some arrangement between Tondaman and the government. Whatever happened, the result was that they issued a statement that they were in sympathy in their whole meeting, but they were not going to strike.
But no, Afiz was a major force in that union at that time.
He was a force, but he was not the dominant force.
And how was the response itself from the people?
Well, from the... there were two forms of response. There was the, should I say, the advanced militants. They were very good, they went into action very well. Then there was a spontaneous response which we never bargained for. For instance, a good deal of the activity down the coastline was pretty spontaneous. You know, women sat on the roads and they coppers and, you know, they formed their own methods of struggle and protest. And that was given, you know, ridden to a new height when the government intervened and started shooting and beating and so on.
But I presume it's correct to say that it was confined to a certain region.
It was main part was in the southern and western province, where of course the majority of the population of Ceylon lives, interestingly. Over 50% of the population. And to the northern provinces, there was quite a lot of activity, not so much strikes as meetings.
That's in the peninsula, I think.
Yes, it is really in the food-producing areas that there wasn't so much activity, where it was confined mainly to the left for this alone, I think, as a protest.
Doesn't it point to a weakness in your organization and the basis of your support at that time?
Which shows that we didn't have enough support among the rural people. At the same time, you see, this did not really, what we didn't see was this did not affect the rural people because, you see, their coupons had been taken away earlier and we hadn't put on a fight on it.
You hadn't?
No, we hadn't. And then those who were producing rice were not given coupons. The students were taken away. And we had made some protests, but we never organized a fight. It was a mistake. Even if we had done it, we would have had their support later on.
Also, the areas in which the Khartal was strongest would seem to indicate that orientation of the left movement revolved around the communication network.
Good, yes, why not? That's one of the forms in which capitalism develops, and therefore the working class develops. But not necessarily so, because I mean, after all, there's a communications in Kunnagala, a train, buses, telegraph, but then nothing happened in Kunnagala.
In Kandy, central province?
There was something, I think there were in Kandy itself, in the town, there was some protest, but not much outside. Well, of course, the when you've got to organize something very quickly, you've got to utilize the existing form of communication. But these were the traditional left areas, you see, where the left had worked from. And even today, that first line is still there. The roundabout Milan is still there.
But how far have you got a rural base today? Or do you bother to work the rural base?
Oh, we do bother. We have some rural base. We'd like to have more. After all, three of our four seats, or say two of our four seats, are from rural base areas, Agresa and Kambodhi. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's plantation economy also there.
Isn't it partly due to Dr.
S. Vikram Singh? No, it's wonderful to put it that way. It's also partly due to the fact that traditionally the communist movement has been there. Mm-hmm. But it's also, it's a rural area. It's not rural. It's still the majority of the people are rural people living in rural conditions.
But taking the whole history of the Communist Party, I was wondering whether one could say that only per country, or sorry, the limited attempts have been made to establish a rural base.
That's true of the early history of the party, yes. Now, of course, it's not true. We are making far from perfunctory attempt. But I don't say that we have succeeded all that time, because we are still going on it.
Haven't you to compete with the SLF?
We have got to compete with everybody.